Hi, it's Diane. We learned just this morning that the President and Mrs. Trump have both tested positive for the coronavirus. We wish them a speedy recovery. We'll be following that story next week. Yesterday, I talked with the New Yorker Susan Glasser and her husband Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for the New York Times, about their new book, The Man Who Ran Washington. It explores the influence of James A. Baker III and why he matters today. Baker served as Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of State, and White House Chief of Staff twice, first under President Reagan, then under President George H.W. Bush. I asked them about their interest in Baker, how the GOP has transformed under Trump, and their thoughts as we head into the final month of the presidential campaign. Susan and Peter, congratulations on the new book. Tell us why you felt it was important to write about Mr. Baker.
Diane, it's so great to be with you. I have to say, what a treat it is. This book was a long time in the making. So what we originally envisioned 7 years ago in the distant mists of the Obama era obviously feels a little bit different today, not only in the middle of the Trump presidency, but as this most contentious of elections comes to a crescendo. Jim Baker, I think even 7 years ago, intrigued us as a figure who was a way to tell a big story about Washington, a period in Washington that's very different than the dysfunction and gridlock that was evident even back in 2013, 2014, and now, of course, is so monumentally divided the city that the deals for which Jim Baker was famous seem impossible, really. Today, as we were talking, Congress has failed utterly, along with President Trump, to do anything about the coronavirus and relief for Americans since late March. Unthinkable to someone like Jim Baker. So we saw him as a way to tell the story of Washington from the end of Watergate to the end of the Cold War, a period that was fundamentally different from our own.
So interesting, because I gather he really did not want to be involved in politics at all after his wife died. He really turned away. But it was George H.W. Bush who persuaded him to move to Washington. Tell us about that, Peter.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a lesson in how the serendipity of history can change everything, right? So Jim Baker meets this guy in Houston in the late 50s, early 60s, really on the country club courts, tennis courts of Houston, and they become doubles partners. They find each other super competitive and they're a good team. And this friendship becomes, the defining partnership of their lives. And when Baker's first wife dies, when Baker's first wife actually first gets her fatal diagnosis, the only person Jim Baker tells is George Bush. He doesn't even tell his wife. He doesn't tell his mother. He doesn't tell his kids. He wants his wife to have her last few months as normal as possible, but he confides in George Bush. That tells you the nature of that friendship, right? That's a real bond in that kind of moment. And you're right. After Mary Stuart Baker passed away and Jim Baker was in a terrible place, he told us that if he ever was going to become an alcoholic, that was the time. And it was George Bush who said, come work with me. Come work on my Senate campaign. And Jim Baker, 40 years old, had never been involved in politics. In fact, he was a Democrat. George Bush said, we can take care of that.
We can take care of that.
Well, you can switch parties.
Yeah, he's going to switch parties and you can learn about politics. And what was fascinating was Baker had an instinct for it, even though he had never been involved with it.
What was it like for the two of you writing this together? What was your means of operation and or cooperation.
Well, luckily we're still on speaking terms, Diane. So
I'm glad.
You know, is actually the second book that Peter and I have done together. And when we lived in Russia and covered sort of the first 4 years of Vladimir Putin's presidency, when we came back, we wrote a book about that called Kremlin Rising, which actually came out, we finished it literally the day that our son Theo was born. So, you know, that was hard.
That's a deadline performance.
This has been much easier than that in many ways. And over a much longer period of time, because of the Trump presidency, we kept getting pulled into the news and didn't have the time to focus on finishing the book that we thought we would have.
We didn't get a baby out of it this time, though.
No, we didn't. We did get a dog, though.
We got a dog.
Summarize, if you will, the power that James Baker wielded in Washington and indeed throughout the world.
It really is a remarkable story. People, I think, have forgotten just how central he was for a long time. He worked for four Republican presidents in one way or another, right? He started off as Gerry Ford's delegate hunter at the last contested convention when he beat back Ronald Reagan for the nomination in 76, ran his fall campaign, brought him back from more than 30 points down and almost came back enough to beat Carter, fell short. He ran George Bush's campaign in 1980 against Reagan, got Bush onto the ticket with Reagan. And then Reagan, even though Baker had run two campaigns against him, makes him his White House chief of staff. And he proved to be a natural at it. Something people today even use the phrase gold standard.
But what was the gift he had? What was it that made him?
Diane, that's such a good question, because really that's the question, I think, why he's such an object of fascination, even to power players in Washington today, in both sides of the aisle, I should say. Many Democrats, as well as Republicans, have great admiration for Baker's skills and tradecraft. And, you know, it's not easily distilled because, of course, look, Baker obviously is smart. He was a fanatically hardworking. He had, you know, been decades as a corporate lawyer in Texas before he came to Washington. So he was really dedicated to meticulous preparation. He was famous for going around with his legal pads full of notes. He would stay in the office in the Reagan White House until every last phone call to a member of Congress or a member of the press was returned. But we all know that Washington is filled with workaholic lawyers, you know, who are very disciplined. So that's not the full secret of his success. Peter and I came to think that in the end, what distilled Baker and what his essence was of that of a deal maker, a natural at understanding the needs of the other person across the table. And, you know, almost the opposite in many ways of the zero-sum politics in which we find ourselves today.
And here you have a man in the White House now who calls himself the greatest deal maker of all time. But you say James Baker was the real thing. How did he do that? Was it respect for others? Was it toughness? Was it listening carefully to where he could make that deal? What was it?
I think it was all of the above, Diane. I think he really did understand, how do you get to where you want to go and make the other person feel like they got what they needed, right? A lot of times negotiators like Baker can recognize how you can give something away that's really not giving anything away, but makes the other person feel like they got what they needed. He understood what the other person's domestic politics would be. He understood what their needs were, and he understood where the line was, how far he could push them and beyond which they couldn't go. So, you know, in 1983, he sits down with Tip O'Neill and they redo Social Security to make it, you know, financially stable for years to come. In 1986, he sits down with Dan Roskinkowski, the Democratic congressman from Chicago, and they rewrite the entire tax code. It hasn't happened since. In 1989, he sits down with Jim Wright and Jimmy Carter, and they find a way to get rid of the Contra War, to resolve this thing that had been a festering sore in Washington for a decade. He didn't mind sitting down with people from the other side, whereas today that's seen as a sign of weakness and capitulation.
What did he see as his greatest accomplishment?
Well, you know, that is a good question. Baker was great at politics, including campaigning. And one of the other things he did was he ran five presidential campaigns. If you can imagine somebody with the portfolio of Karl Rove combined with that of Henry Kissinger, it's unthinkable today. But of course, he wanted to escape the label of just merely being a political handler. And what he was most proud of was being a statesman. And look, the end of the Cold War alone is worth a book in terms of what Jim Baker and George H.W. Bush did. And we certainly, that was our interest in a way, starting out the book, having come from being foreign correspondent in the former Soviet Union. And, you know, really, it's remarkable what Baker did in creating the diplomatic conditions and the framework under which German unification would occur. And, you know, history in hindsight looks very inevitable, but at the time, of course, it's much less certain. And I think I came away from this book with a renewed appreciation and sort of awe at how many things could have gone wrong after the fall of the Berlin Wall in November 1989. Nobody had expected, even a few months earlier, that German unification was something that could happen quickly. And events moved so fast. It wasn't just, by the way, the Soviets who were wary of German unification, but actually the British and the French, who had, after all, fought two world wars against the Germans, were extremely concerned about this. Margaret Thatcher was as much of an obstacle to be managed in this situation as anyone else. And then there were, of course, the constant pressures that Bush and Baker faced from conservatives at home who wanted to enforce really a victor's peace on the Soviets and to sort of, you know, dance on the wall, as it were.
How much time did you all get to spend with him?
Well, he was very generous with his time. We sat down with him to start in 2013, and he basically agreed from the start to open his life up to us. He gave us full access to his archives at Princeton, which nobody had had, access to his archives at Rice University, which is founded really by his grandfather. He gave us personal papers that weren't in either of those places, and he sat down with us in Houston at his home, at his office in Houston. We went to his ranch in Wyoming. We sat with him multiple times in Washington. We interviewed all eight of his kids. We interviewed his wife, who's wonderful. We interviewed his 106-year-old nanny, who's still around. Isn't that amazing? And so we got a real opening into his life beyond politics. I think that's one of the things that really surprised us about Baker, was sort of the family dynamic, the tragedy we already talked about with his first wife, and the difficulties and the challenges of putting together a new family with so many kids, and some of them having a trouble adjusting.
What about regrets? Did you hear from him, "This is what I regret"?
You know, it's interesting. He's a super, super self-confident man at the age of 90. He has obviously lived a life in full, as it were. On the one hand, he was very open with us, especially actually about his family troubles and the challenges. He and his wife, his second wife, together, after his first wife passed away, he actually ended up marrying one of his first wife's very close friends. She came to the marriage with three children. He had four already. So it was like a Brady Bunch, except it was like a Brady Bunch from hell, Diane. This did not go well. And then they ultimately had one of their together as well. So they had eight children, very contentious. So I was surprised that a man of the old school like Baker was so open with us about the challenges of his life on the one hand. However, he's not a super introspective man, not a man who looks back with regret. At one point, he did volunteer, maybe, just maybe, the negative excesses of the 1988 campaign against Michael Dukakis and the Willie Horton ad. He said, maybe you could call that something regret. But then he said, no, it's,
he took it back.
He's comfortable with his record, and he's gonna go to bat on that.
I think to the extent that there's anything he didn't accomplish,
yes,
right, if this is a regret, is the fact that Bush and Baker failed to win the 1992 election meant that he didn't get a second 4 years as Secretary of State. And he really thought that the Madrid peace process that he had started had a chance of bearing fruit in that second term. And we won't know whether that's true or not, but he had such a unique skill set. The lost opportunity of watching him build on that first conference, the first time the Israelis sat down with all their Arab neighbors, that's something I think he would have liked to have tried.
So how close did he and George H.W. Bush remain in their lives? Was there any period of friction?
You know, Diane, that was one question I think that Peter and I were very interested to know the answer too. And I think that we found that there was probably more friction than it was commonly known at sort of this period when they were at the heights, you know, from the 1980 campaign through Bush's presidency, right? This was an extraordinary and high stakes period. There were moments at all of those when the friendship was tested, you know, when you're, they might've been like an older brother and a younger brother initially, but if you're in a family business, that can, you know, cause friction. And so in 1980 campaign was one thing. Bush, you know, ran in the primaries against Reagan. He actually did better in many ways than expected. Baker was running that campaign, but there was a time at which it was, in Baker's view, the time to get out, especially because he hoped to still secure the vice presidential nomination for Bush. But Bush, very competitive guy, very prideful guy, did not want to do that. And Baker essentially forced him, perhaps before he was ready, to acknowledge that there's a moment where he is accused of leaking to the Washington Post that, you know, the campaign is out of money basically and isn't going to compete in California. And Barbara Bush in particular and some of the other family members felt that was Bush trying to jam up, Baker trying to jam up Bush. So that was one. Number two, in the 1988 campaign, you know, I think Bush actually made a real almost declaration of independence. There was a lot of talk already about how formidable Baker was. Was he going to be like the co-president? I don't think Bush liked that. And he picked Dan Quayle as a vice presidential candidate. And he did not really consult with Jim Baker about that. It was a disastrous rollout. And I think Baker was not happy, to say the least, about that. And then, of course, when Bush lost, a lot of recriminations in the family that Baker, who had been Secretary of State, had very reluctantly come back to oversee the campaign, that he had done so too late, that his heart wasn't in it, you know, that he wasn't willing to do what was required. So that friction. But then in the end, after they left public life, I think they resumed their life really as almost family members, you know, brothers. And it tells you everything that when George H.W. Bush died, the last person who was really there three times on the day that he died, Baker was at his home and he was literally rubbing his feet as he passed away.
So let's move forward then to the election of George W. Bush in the race against Al Gore and the Florida recount. How much did you talk with Jim Baker about that?
Well, I see we did a lot, and it does seem even more relevant today, doesn't it?
It sure does.
We're heading toward a process that may be Florida on steroids. And there's no question when our Democrats told us that when they heard that Baker was going to be in charge of W's effort in Florida, that they figured, oh gosh, now we're probably going to lose. Because he was such a master of both, not just the law, which is obviously an issue there, but the politics of the moment. And Baker understood that it was important that Bush never be behind in the count, that if at any point Bush fell behind Gore, they would lose their argument that they had the high ground position, that they were the ones who had won and that Gore was trying to take it away from them. And they didn't. They never lost the lead through the entire time. The other thing that Baker did that was important was to sort of throw away conservative orthodoxy, which says you don't go to the federal courts on these state, you know, election disputes and say, forget that, we're going to go, you know, we're going to go all the way to the Supreme Court. He was the first one really in the Bush camp who said, this is going to end the Supreme Court. It's where we have to eventually get to. And he forced that over people who kind of objected to that.
It really makes me wonder whether Donald Trump is reading off that same page.
The one difference though, I would say is that in that case, you had two candidates in Bush and Gore, and you had people like Baker who were involved, who still had a fundamental respect for the process. They weren't trying to undermine the legitimacy of American democracy, I think, the way we're kind of seeing now, right? They weren't trying to blow it up. They were trying to, you know, power their way through the process as best they could. But when it was over, Gore gave a very gracious concession speech, and Bush gave a very, you know, unifying, we're all in this together, I reached out to Democrats kind of speech, and Baker, you know, was the diplomat. And in fact, he sat down afterwards to have an election commission with Jimmy Carter to talk about how they can make elections better. You don't see that today. What you see today is somebody who's willing to throw a giant big bomb in the middle of the election and let it blow up, even at the cost of American faith in our own system.
And even today, there are those who wonder, had Al Gore insisted on a recount of the entire state of Florida, whether the outcome of that election would have been a different one.
Yeah, they did. There were two media organization recounts that were done after the process was over to try to count them ourselves. In effect, the New York Times is one of them. In all the scenarios that were at play at that moment, in other words, everything Al Gore had asked for or a court had ordered at one point, if all of those had played out, Bush still would have won, according to that count. But there was one scenario where Gore was close enough that he might have, in fact, come out. And that's if he had asked, as you say, for a recount in all 60-some counties, which he never asked for. And it was probably a mistake on his part. It was a tactical mistake, but you're right. That was the one scenario where he had a chance.
More from Susan Glasser and Peter Baker when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with New Yorker staff writer Susan Glasser and New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker. Their new book is The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. Do you both admire Jim Baker?
First of all, he's one of the most personable figures I've ever encountered in politics. He has a natural ability. He wouldn't have been such a good deal maker if he wasn't. He has a natural ability to connect with people across all sorts of different divides. And in part, that's due to his unique background, right? You know, there's a part in the book, one of the things he was really good at, right, was working Capitol Hill and the different members of Congress. And, you know, talking with one of his former aides who remembers him going up to the Hill and literally talking duck hunting with Jesse Helms in one office and then going next door and talking opera with Chris Dodd. And he could do that without, really bullshitting too much. You know, he was both a Princetonian of many generations and, a Houstonian of many generations. And so he has a great facility and ability to interact with people. He's extremely canny about the world. For someone who has such a pedigree, he is remarkably down to earth. He's open and curious, well into his 80s. He is not an intellectual, you know, he's not a sort of Kissinger. He's not going to talk to you about the Treaty of Westphalia or anything like that. He's deeply conservative, small c, not so much an ideologue, which is why he got crosswise with many of the sort of faithful of the Reagan Revolution, right? He's a pragmatist in life and in politics. But he was at his powers, I think, at his height. He was also a calculating man who was not very close in a personal sense to those who were around him, probably not his family or those he worked with either. In fact, one of his advisors told us that he worked closely with Jim Baker for years, was never invited to dinner with him, never called him by his first name. So, you know, he's a study in power, the good, the bad, the ugly. But, you know, he's not LBJ, right? I mean, this is a man who I think has lived a life for the most part of great accomplishment and rectitude.
So let's turn to the present day. Does he support Donald Trump?
Peter keeps me.
No, I had a couple.
Look, here's the thing, Diane. We watched him for 5 years tortured over this question of Donald Trump. As I've just described this man to you, right? He's the un-Trump in terms of his personal views, his character, and many of his political and ideological views. Trump is anathema to him because of his incompetence of his White House from a man who was the gold standard of White House chief of staff. He's anathema, but he told us Trump was nuts, that he was crazy, but he voted for him. in 2016, very reluctantly, and said that he felt that as a Republican, he was going to support the nominee of his party. Since Trump has been president, he's again wrestled with what to do. At one point, he told us that he would consider voting for Joe Biden. Then 2 months later, he took it back and he said, well, no, don't say that I'm going to do that. And now he just doesn't want to talk to us about it anymore.
The parable, I think, for the modern Republican Party, right? Yeah. There are a lot of Republicans, they don't particularly like him. He doesn't share their ideology in a lot of ways, right? Baker is an internationalist, a free trader, a believer in alliances, a believer in American leadership in the world. And yet they have had a hard time breaking with him. So Baker's compromise was, I won't endorse him. I'm not going to support him. Every time Trump has asked him to do something, Baker has kept his distance, but he did vote for him.
Let me ask you about the debates. What was your big takeaway?
Like you, Diane, I'm still recovering. If ever there was a time for day drinking, it was, my God. It was really, I found it to be extremely difficult to watch. I can only imagine for a voter who is not living in this Washington world day in and day out, they would have had a similar reaction. I literally couldn't understand a lot of what was being said because, of course, Donald Trump was trying for me not to understand it. Clearly, this was an effort at voter suppression, at just turning people off to politics, period. What a shame. What a tragedy. What I find most amazing is that this was actually seemed to be Trump's purposeful strategy, you know, and I can't imagine, you know, he really thinks that any undecided voter is going to say, well, pick him. Who wants to vote for a jerk? Let's be honest, you know. So that's why to me, it seems like a massive exercise in voter suppression, because clearly it wasn't an effort in voter persuasion.
Peter, your colleague at the New York Times, David Leonhardt, wrote this morning, as we are speaking on Thursday morning, he wrote that Trump actually fears Joe Biden. And he talked about his fear that he cannot beat him, his extraordinary efforts to prevent Biden from becoming the nominee, that he really didn't care about any of the other possible nominees because he felt that Joe Biden was going to win. I wonder how you react to that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I mean, look, Biden is the one Democrat who was running for the nomination who was hard for Trump to demonize, characterize, and pigeonhole, right? It's easier to make liberals scary to his audience, and it's easy to mock people who, you know, with pejorative nicknames. Biden is a known quantity to many Americans. He's generally perceived to be likable. He's generally perceived to be mainstream. He's generally perceived to be, you know, mature. And it's hard to sort of take a guy who's been in our public life for so long and transform him into something else. And that's what an incumbent president facing this kind of challenge needs to do. In some ways, Barack Obama did that with Mitt Romney. In some ways, you know, other candidates, you know, George W. Bush did that with John Kerry. And I think that Biden is a much harder figure for Trump to do that. Look at where the polls are. The Washington Post poll this week had the race at 53-43 for Biden. Guess where it was in July of 2019? 53-43. Biden versus Trump. In other words, it has not moved. That number is exactly where it was 15 months ago. Americans decided a long time ago what they think of Donald Trump. They either like him or don't like him, and they haven't changed their minds.
But what about Trump's effort to undermine faith in the voting and the balloting? And that's why it makes me think of James Baker and what happened in Florida. Could the same scenario happen going straight to the Supreme Court once again?
I think you're right, except unfortunately, I think this is much worse, much, much worse. And here's why. Number one, George W. Bush and Al Gore believed in the system and in fact were mortified and concerned that this conflict in Florida was going to undermine the system. And, you know, had it come to that, I truly believe that either George W. Bush or Al Gore would have done what they could, including step aside for the good of the system, number one. Number two, they were eager to, when in the end, it wasn't Jim Baker who decided the outcome, although he made smart moves that might have, made it more inevitable. It was the Supreme Court that made that decision. And the Supreme Court arguably did acquire more of a political reputation as a result of that decision that lingers to this day. But it was a time when there was more faith in institutions, number one, than we have right now across the board. Number two, we have a candidate, Donald Trump, who has chosen this as his only strategy for breaking out at this point, to change the composition of the electorate or to cause turmoil and questions about the outcome. And he's done that, as Peter pointed out, because the polls have otherwise been so immovable and so steady. Back in 1988, when Bush and Baker engineered the greatest comeback of recent presidential politics, 17 points recovered from Michael Dukakis in the course of the fall campaign, they had a strategy too. It was a negative strategy. Go negative, assault Michael Dukakis and bring him down. And that worked. Donald Trump has tried to go negative on Joe Biden, but it hasn't worked. So his strategy is to go negative on America, essentially.
That's quite a statement, Susan, including restricting voting by mail somehow, or certainly putting doubts in the minds of American voters as to whether their vote is going to be counted. What about Trump's call out to poll watchers? Thousands and thousands of poll watchers, to what extent is that likely to intimidate or even prevent people from going to the polls?
Diane, among all the things that he said, that was one of the things that really caused me the most alarm. First of all, I've been listening to Trump and watching his statements about the election. He's called it a rigged election for months now. In fact, that's been his play with every election going back. He did that in 2016 and 2018. What's new is what appears to be almost explicit calls to violence and intimidation. That's something that I haven't seen before, and I found it to be very scary.
How did you react to his closing remarks, Peter, at the debate about that group of anarchists?
He has shown several times throughout his presidency an unwillingness to make the kind of clear, full-throated statement that a normal president would make about racists, about white supremacists, about right-wing as well as left-wing violence. And he has entirely tried to shift the conversation to Antifa, which he has made out to be this great threat, even though the FBI has said that white supremacists are the greater threat right now. And it's, he doesn't want to push away people who support him, and they take it that way. They took the statements that he made, this group, Proud Boys, as an affirmation rather than a denunciation. And they've made it a slogan almost. Stand back, stand by is now their slogan practically. And it really troubled a lot of Republicans because it's not where they want their party to go. They see an increasingly diversifying America, and they know that if they stick with a completely message oriented toward white Americans that seem to turn off non-white Americans, is a long-term prescription for electoral defeat. So they're left in this very awkward position of trying to distance themselves from their own president 30-some days out from an election.
So who is the Jim Baker for Donald Trump? Who's going to take on questions about the election for him?
I don't know if we have a name of like an election type Sherpa person at this point, but we're already in court. The thing about Florida is all these things got litigated after the election.
That's
which
right.
Made it hard. One thing is happening now, we have 150 some lawsuits by both sides, all sides, interest groups, as well as the parties, already in the courts over questions about the mail-in ballots, about postmarks and whether the sleeves have to
be naked ballots.
The naked ballot. All these things are already being litigated. In some ways, that might be an advantage because we didn't argue about the butterfly ballot in Florida until after it was too late. Now, or at least there's some effort to try to make a set of rules for the game beforehand, but he won't respect these rulings if he finds that they are to his disadvantage. He's made very clear that any result other than a clear-cut victory for him will be something he questions. He questions the 2016 election result, even though he won, by saying, look, I even won the popular vote, even though he got 3 million fewer votes than Hillary Clinton, by claiming that somehow 3 million people voted illegally, immigrants and so forth. So he's made very clear what he's going to do here. The playbook is right in front of us. And the question is, how does the system respond?
So considering the fiasco that was the debate the other night, should there be two more debates? And if so, how should those rules change? Or should we knock off the debate?
As a personal matter, is there anyone who's not dreading watching this? Again, there's a different format that's set for the next one. It's more of a town hall. It's hard to imagine that Donald Trump is going to, attack voters. Interestingly, when there was a recent ABC News town hall in Philadelphia that Trump did, that was one of his most disastrous performances. Not disastrous in the way that his attacks on Biden were the other night, but disastrous, I thought, because it was so obvious he's not encountered skeptical questions from outside of his MAGA bubble. And, that's why this is a demagogue for whom his rallies are the preferred setup, because it's all adulation and no negative feedback. So he actually had a real tough time with the uncommitted voters in that ABC town hall. I don't know what he takes away from that experience or not. But look, it's an American tradition. It's an important American tradition, which is why Biden's campaign has said absolutely he will be continuing to debate, because I think there is an expectation on the part of the American people that these men are asking to be our leaders for 4 years, and they need to come out and meet each other and meet the public.
Do you feel the same way?
Well, it's not for me to take a position on it as a reporter. I do think that it's not, it's an opportunity for Americans to see their candidates, and for good or bad, and they can make a judgment. I would not want to be the next moderator. I will tell you that, as I don't envy them. I think Chris Wallace did, as good a job as you could given the situation. I don't know how you managed to stop a president of the United States if he's going to do what he did there. There's some talk about cutting off microphones. I don't know that that would work. I get the temptation. You know what it's like to have control of a microphone.
I do indeed.
But, as Chris Wallace said, and to my colleague at the New York Times, Michael Grimbaugh, he said, look, he would, even if you cut off his microphone, he's still going to talk. You can still hear him on stage. It would still be disruptive, and it might not be seen as respectful by the audience. It's a hard thing to know. I don't know what the answer is here.
Well, that's right. Turning off a microphone of a president of the United States, the blowback on the journalists who chose to do that, especially from a president who has made journalists the quote enemies of the people for his entire presidency, that might play exactly into why he created that circus in the first place.
Susan, what is your greatest hope? And what is your greatest fear about November 3rd?
An early night would be, a good thing. Now, of course, journalists, the traditional thing, and in perhaps simpler times was, vote the story. Obviously, nobody is rooting for mayhem, division, and conflict and uncertainty. So these doom scenarios, 4 years ago, we had them, Diane, as well, because Trump was talking about a rigged election. He was talking 4 years ago about how he wasn't sure he was going to accept the election results in advance. He didn't commit to it. But I discounted them 4 years ago in a way that I'm not prepared to do today. I am deeply, deeply concerned about where we're headed as a country.
Do you feel the same way, Peter?
My hope would be for clarity, right? That there's not a lot of doubt, or at least the numbers are such that we don't really have a reason to consider the election to be anything other than what it is. The worry is that we will have a changing result between the initial count on election day, which might favor one candidate because they're not counting all the mail-in ballots right away, and that number will change over time, and people will see that number changing, and rather than see that as the natural result of counting, which is what we'll most, what we're going to see, instead they start to suspect that means somebody's doing something. And of course, the president will encourage that if it's his lead, if he has a lead that then seems to be shrinking. It's a real problem, I think. For instance, Ohio isn't even going to count, I think, is this right, their mail-in ballots until 10 days after the election, because they want to be able to make sure everybody can get their ballot in, which is a good thing. But the idea that we would go 10 days without uncertainty really raises all sorts of questions. And I think that we in the media have a responsibility to help our readers and our viewers understand what this process is going to be like, to understand what's normal and what's not normal, what's to be expected and what's not to be expected, rather than to make it look like something untoward is happening if it's not.
Well, it's going to be quite a night.
Or a week. Or a month.
Or a month, indeed. I want to thank you both, Susan Glasser, Peter Baker. Thank you both.
Thank you, Diane. It's wonderful to be with you.
Always.
That was New Yorker staff writer Susan Glasser and her husband, New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker. Their new book is titled The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.